So I hope you still have energy to listen to this last talk. So I'm going to talk about something a bit different from what, for example, Shai has just talked before. So rather than focusing on large cosmological boxes, I will mostly talk about the successes and failures of simulations that try to form individual galaxies in a cosmological context using a zoom-in technique that allows to follow a single galaxy at very high resolution. But of course, the price to pay is that you cannot actually look at population properties. However, this approach is complementary and extremely useful to understand how well we can perform in terms of trying to reproduce in detail the properties of galaxies, for example, these galaxies. And in that sense, it's good to start with a little of a historical background on where we come from in this field. So in the last two decades, we have seen for a long time a number of persistent issues when trying to simulate formation of galaxies inside Lambda CDM. One issue has been discussed a lot in many talks, the problem of having an excess stellar mass, which is, of course, the first motivation to have feedback in order to reduce the stellar masses. But other issues that has always been around for a long time have been the problem of having oversized stellar bulges, which reflect the fact that simulations typically had too much low angular momentum material ending up in a stellar phase from the cold gas phase. And related to that, also the issue of forming galaxies with too steep rotation curves, which I would say it's only in the last 2 or 3 years that people have began to move a bit away from these two issues. And the underlying physical processes that relevant for all this are several. Of course, the angular momentum transport, which is due to several mechanisms, both outside the galaxy and inside the galaxy. The thermodynamics of the gas phase, and in particular, whether or not we are cooling the right amount of gas. And then at the end is also the rate of conversion of gas into stars, which has been talked a lot about in this conference. But then there's also a lot of underlying numerical issues that people have looked at through the years, and sometimes people tend to forget, again, what's the historical record of the previous efforts. And we have seen in the past that a lot of the issues have improved as we have improved the resolution. And just to show you, this was the situation in end of the 1990s, where the simulated galaxies, if you were plotting the angular momentum, the specific angular momentum at the exponential d-scale length versus the rotation speed in the simulations, you were getting these squares and stars over here. And then this is where the data, the real galaxies, should lie. So you had a more than an order of magnitude deficiency in the angular momentum and given rotation speed. Now, this was reflected in the fact that rotation curves of galaxies formed in simulations at that time typically had the shape that you can see here, extremely steep, which has nothing to do with the shape of the rotation curve of a galaxy like the Milky Way, which is relatively flat. And that's because you were getting too much material in the center, in the bulge, too much low angular momentum material. So as time went by, various people have tried to improve resolution and feedback models, and we went from situations like these to a situation more like that at the end of 2000s. And you can see that, for example, from this green line to this black line, the improvement has been mostly resolution. The feedback model in this particular case that I'm showing remained the same, but the resolution improved by a factor of almost 16, and this improved issues such as artificial dissipation of angular momentum by various numerical problems. So this is something that we should never forget, that numerical resolutions is not a secondary aspect in when we try to simulate any kind of system. So the simulation that we'll talk about adopt mostly the same kind of feedback model that Alison also alluded to in her talk. The so-called blast wave feedback, where essentially what we do is we shut off the cooling of the gas for a time scale which is of order 10 million years. The original justification for choosing this model, which you can find in the Stinson et al. Paper, is based on reproducing the blast wave evolution for supernova type 2 as predicted by the McKeown-Striker model. Essentially, this time scale is related to the sum of the set of Taylor and snowplow phase. And because we have limited resolution in cosmological simulations, every time we have supernova exploding associated with a stellar particle, we never explode just one supernova, but more than one. So implicitly, we are actually summing up, we are overlapping the blast waves. Now, if you try to calibrate these recipes, as we tried many years ago on isolated galaxies, so not in a cosmological context, the typical outcome that you get is in small galaxies, you have a very turbulent ISM with significant outflows, whereas in galaxies like the Milky Way, you get sort of galactic fountains, but essentially no baryons leave the halo. So it's a very mild form of feedback with the parameters that we've been using through the years for big galaxies. And the calibration has been done since the time of the Stinson et al. Paper, mostly to try to reproduce observable of galaxies at low redshift. And this crucial parameter, which is the efficiency of the supernovae energy that goes into thermal energy of the gas, which is what also Shai was mentioning before. In our case, in simulation, varies between 0.4 and 0.8, so it's still relatively high, close to 100%. Now, the one major improvement that we have seen, at least in the context of our model of feedback, which is also mentioned before by Allison, is when we went through increasing the star formation density threshold from the typical threshold that people were using in this business until a few years ago, that was 0.1 atoms per centimeter cubed, so the typical density of the warm neutral medium. And then as resolution increased, we felt confident we could use a more realistic threshold, which is closer to what you have in real galaxies, so it's closer to the density of the molecular phase. In dwarf galaxies, which are easier to simulate because you need less particles per unit mass, if you want, you can go up to 100 or more atoms per centimeter cube. In larger galaxies, we typically go up to a few tens. But this is a major improvement relative to what was done before. And I'm going to show you three case studies of the same kind of feedback model and similar resolution in three different mass scales, the scale of dwarf galaxies around 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 11 solar masses, so fairly large, wide range, the scale of Milky Way-sized galaxies, and at the very end, depending on how much time I will have, I will show some new results of massive galaxies in 10 to the 13 solar mass halos, and this is mostly done with the gasoline code. Now, the reason why in our model the effect of feedback is amplified by going up with the threshold is that we simply use a star from Schmidt law to produce our stars in the gas, and then we dump the supernova energy there. If you have a higher threshold, the two things happen. First, as you can see by comparing this with high threshold of star formation with this same simulation with low threshold of star formation, the ISM becomes much more inhomogeneous because you let the gas reach high densities, which before you were essentially converting into stars too early for the gas to reach these high density peaks. So you have a completely different evolution of the gas density field. The PDF would look very different. And the other effect is that because the number of new stars that you make is proportional to the square root of the threshold that you choose, and that means also the number of supernovae will be proportional to that. So per unit mass, you will dump more energy in the same volume. And so both effects, the inhomogeneity of the ISM and the fact that you dump more energy locally, amplify the effect of feedback. And then we started using this high threshold, insufficiently high resolution simulation that allowed that. We found what Allison was discussing before. So we found that in the case of dwarf galaxies, we were able to remove this low angular momentum material, which has always been the main issue, and therefore get rid of the bulge, which was forming even in low mass galaxies until this simulation was done. And then the other effect of that was because of the stronger feedback, we started removing a lot of baryons. So at the end, these dwarf galaxy simulations, which end up with a mass scale similar to the LMC, have about a third of the cosmic baryon fraction. So they've lost two-thirds of the baryons through winds. And the other important result, which is what actually we were after, was, as I said, to get rid of the bulge and obtain, at the end, a nearly complete exponential from resolution scale to the outer disk. And then as a side effect of using this model, what happened is the formation of dark matter cores, and I'm not going to discuss that because Alison has already discussed that at length. And so you can see why that happens from the rotation curve. You know, previous simulations done with our code without the high star formation threshold and a lower resolution, we obtained these very steep rotation curves, and then now with higher resolution and high star formation threshold, we went down to these more realistic, slowly rising curves, which are the result of not only removing more baryons, but also creating a core in the dark matter. So the winds selectively remove low angular momentum material. You can see this in this plot shows the specific angular momentum as a function of time for the gas that is in the outflows. And the blue is the total baryon. So the baryons have, on average, this angular momentum as a function of time, but the gas that is in the outflow has typically lower angular momentum because that's what you remove, essentially, is the low angular momentum material, which is what you have at the center where you have the higher star formation rate and higher supernova rate. So this selective effect of low angular momentum removal is what actually produces a bulge-less galaxy in these simulations. Then lately we have looked at trying to look at more galaxies, so simulate a group of dwarfs essentially with different masses in order to explore how, by using the same recipe and the same resolution in a more wide variety of initial conditions, we were still getting realistic results or not. And so this is a paper that appeared recently, and just to give you an example of the kind of object that we simulate in this particular paper, these are the seven dwarfs, as we call them. They have a mass scale in terms of virial halo mass that goes from similar to the LMC, a few times 10 to the 10, to very, very small, comparable to some of the faintest dwarfs in the local group, about 10 to the 8 total virial mass. The stellar mass at the end of the simulations, a redshift 0, varies from 10 to the 8 in the biggest dwarfs to 0 in the smallest one. So we have galaxies that don't form stars at all, because they simply never go above the threshold. The gas never gets dense enough to form stars. And then we compare the M star M-halo relation with the abundance matching prediction. This is where, so this galaxy is something I'm going to talk later, but the dwarfs, the ones that form stars, they end up either relatively close or fairly below the prediction from the Beruzzi et al. Paper. So some of them are actually much less efficient at forming stars than even the abundance matching would predict. Now, a major feature here, which has been seen also in other simulations shown this week, is the fact that we have a very bursty star formation in all the dwarfs. And this bursty star formation is what produces these potential fluctuations that cause the formation of the cores. Now, the important thing to do is to check the star formation histories against known objects. And you know, lately in the local group, we finally are collecting data on field dwarfs, which is something that is happening only recently, using HST, where you can really resolve the CMB diagram. You can finally reconstruct the star formation history. That's an example in a paper that we co-authored with the observers that got these beautiful observations of IC1613, which is one of the dwarf irregulars in the local group at about megaparsec from the Milky Way. And these are, the red lines are two of the simulations in the group of seven dwarfs on the same mass scale, at least in terms of final stellar mass. And you can see that, yeah, the star formation histories, of course, are not following exactly the observed ones, but the fact that you form stars relatively late, which is the main message to take away from the data, seems to be reasonably reproduced by the simulations, which wasn't the case before. The ones that form very little stars have essentially star formation only very late. We only know one dwarf in the local group that has such a kind of star formation history, is Leo A, which is not shown here. But we are getting many more, hopefully. We have a proposal we just submitted to get more HST observations of field dwarfs. We will see whether this type of very late star formation history is more common than it is at the moment in data. So the winds in these dwarfs are pretty effective. You can see that, you know, by redshift zero, they are covering up to 16 virial radii. If you just trace the winds by the metals, tracing the metals, they reach out to 16 virial radii, so very, very far from the center of the galaxies. And that's the impact parameter that you can see, you know, pushes to about 16 million radii by redshift zero. So you're polluting the IgM to fairly large radius, but in terms of gas that you lose, you typically lose between 50% and 70% of the gas. At the end, the cold gas fraction that remains in the dwarfs, for the biggest dwarfs, is reasonably comparable to data. For the faintest ones, we still have an issue that it seems like we are under-predicting the H1 content. So we may actually need to retain, we may need to have more H1, but it's not clear how to do it, because the luminosities of these simulated dwarfs is already comparable to some of the faintest ones. So it's really some kind of possibly, you know, limitation of the feedback model that doesn't actually gives the right self-regulation between H1 and the stars. So the metallicity luminosity relation also seems to be reasonably reproduced. This is for the gas and for the stars. So the final message to take away is it looks like several observables from these simulations are reasonably matching what is known about the local group dwarfs and the nearby dwarfs. Now, dwarfs are easy in a way because, you know, it's easy to have an efficient feedback in dwarfs. And as you go to larger mass scales, this might not be the case. So you don't want to retune the recipes again, because otherwise there's no way to make predictions. And so what we did then a couple of years ago was to say, well, let's now use the same exact subgrid model for feedback, but for everything else, also for the cosmic UV background, for, of course, the star formation recipe, for the density threshold, and so on and so on, and try to see what happens if we do this in a zooming cosmological run at the scale of the Milky Way. So a halo that ends up at the end, 10 to the 12, roughly 10 to the 12, a bit less than that, 8 times 10 to the 11 solar masses by redshift zero. And so this is what we call the Harris simulation, which is now 2 years old, but has produced follow-ups that I'm going to discuss very quickly later. I think it's fair to say that at the time when we ran the simulation, there was no cosmological simulation of an individual Milky Way-sized galaxy that was producing a disk-dominated galaxy with a small bulge. Okay, so all groups, including our group, was struggling with the problem that I was mentioning at the beginning, that even though rotation curves were getting more realistic, the bulge was always dominant or comparable to the disk. Whereas in late-type galaxies, which are the most common galaxies in the nearby universe, including our Milky Way, the bulge is subdominant, clearly subdominant in terms of stellar mass. Now, this, compared to what other people have shown this week, these Harris runs now look extremely crude in terms of subgrid physics. We don't have anything like radiative feedback. We don't have H2 formation, H2 cooling. At that time, we were still using a vanilla SPH, not a new SPH. We have rerun now also with newer SPH versions with pressure base and metal and thermal diffusion. But at that time, there was nothing like that. But yet, again, with the enough resolution, 10 to the 4 solar masses, which is still, I believe, even today, even compared to some of the latest work done with a repo, it's still higher resolution than even what the group using HaRepo has done so far. So with this high resolution and with the ability, thanks to the resolution, to raise the star formation density threshold, we were actually able to obtain a galaxy at the end that had finally a realistic batch to disk ratio, a realistic disk scale length, reasonable mass, and value of the rotation speeds, the real rotation speed, not the circular velocity, so the real rotation measured from the gas at the solar radius. So matching most of the constraints that you have for the Milky Way and for other late-type spirals. The winds in this case are much less effective, as you would expect. So they reach out only to about 1.5 to 2 billion radii. So the metals, you know, which trace well the extent of the winds, they as you can see in the metal bubble, this is the virial radius, redshift 2.5. And it's the same all the time. They never reach out more than 2 virial radii. And at low redshift, actually, they become extremely ineffective. Below redshift 1.5, there is essentially no ejection of baryons anymore from the galaxy. Everything is retained. The end result is that you lower the baryon fraction below cosmic, but by only a little bit, by only 30%. That this reduction of the baryon fraction and the fact that the stronger outflows regulate star formation is enough to put Eris down to the prediction of the M-star Himmler, the abundance matching. That's the black dot here. This is not the latest one, it's the Beruzzi et al. From 2010, but in this mass range, the prediction is still more or less the same today. Then here you see other galaxies that were simulated before by our group without the high star formation threshold, without the high resolution, and they were sitting clearly well above. They were inconsistent. These are other simulations by other people later on, which are now consistent as well. And other groups have done simulation now that are consistent. So this is now not a big result, but at the time, it was the first galaxy that actually made it to the M-star Himmler relation. Tully-Fisher relation, you can see that here. Here showing the Eris and then a lower resolution version of Eris, which was a more offset from the predicted Tully-Fisher. Constraints from the kinematics of velostars in the Milky Way, they roughly agree with the, well, the simulation roughly agrees with those. This is an I-band image. This is the profile from which you can do a photometric fitting and extract a burst to disk ratio in the I-band, which is about 0.45. But the things that don't work will come, don't worry. So the disk clearly stands up. This is similar to what Forker showed. As I said, today there are other simulations that are obtaining similar results. The disk is clearly seen when you plot the circularity. The distribution in circularities of stars, you can see the low angular momentum, low circularity component, which is what you call generic to the sphere, and a very sharp peak with very high circularity, which means stars that have nearly circular orbit, which is what you define as the disk. And you can look at the star formation history of both components, and what you find is that the spheroid forms early and quenches a low redshift, whereas the disk forms later, the blue one, and continues to form stars, although at a reduced rate, down to fairly low redshift. It reaches about a solar mass per year. An important constraint, which was actually matched by Eris, but we are having a hard time now matching with the newer simulations that we are doing, with better, supposedly better subgroup physics, but as you will show, they are actually getting less predictive. So this is important. I think it's important that everybody working in this business of trying to make these galaxies keeps this in mind as an important constraint. This is the H kinematics relation for galaxies, for the Milky Way in particular. So as you know, there are beautiful data with SEGWAY that were published in a series of papers by Joe Bovi et al., which have shown that there is a continuum between subcomponents when you look at the kinematics, or the velocity dispersion and the age and abundances of stars in the Milky Way. There is no real separation between thick and thin disks. There's just a continuum. And of course, we have known for a long time that there is a component with very cold kinematics, which is what we call the thin disk, and has a very small scale height. And you can see here, in our redshift zero snapshot, when we look at different cohorts of stars with different ages, we can clearly recognize the younger stars. These are the blue and cyan and green lines. The younger stars forming the last few giga years are kinematically cold. Their velocity dispersion around 20, even less than that, kilometers per second at the solar radius. And their typical scale heights are less than 100 parsecs, so just barely at the resolution level, essentially. And this kind of constraint, I fear, as I will show later, that is actually becoming difficult to match with newer simulations that have more complex feedback models. The galaxy also has a pseudo bulge at the end, which is typical for late-type spirals, or blue bulge with an exponential scale length, or if you want a Cirsich less than 2. And that comes from the evolution of a previous bar at higher redshift. An important effect of the threshold is if you try and check what you would be getting with the older models with lower star formation threshold, that's the difference. So in a lower star formation threshold companion simulation, the disk is much smaller, much more compact. It has a higher density. You can see that from this density map here. there's a very strong density peak at the center, which we don't have in the standard ARIS with high threshold. And so it really looks different. It's much more compact. There is less high angular momentum material. So that's the effect of feedback getting stronger with the high threshold. And so the rotation curves in the low threshold run is peaky and steep as in the old previous simulations. And of course, it's reduced to something more flat as you go to higher threshold. So these are all diagnostics that tell you that the higher threshold, because in our model, powers up the effect of feedback, allows to remove the low angular momentum material, and allows to get more extended disks with smaller bulges. However, when you look at the evolution of the M-star-M-Mellor relation over time, we do match it roughly at redshift zero, as I was showing before. This is a Mostar et al. Rather than Beruzzi, but it's still the abundance matching. But as you go to earlier times, we are off. We are clearly off. And I think this is a difficulty that most simulations have currently in fitting this M-star-M-Mellor relation at all redshifts. Seems to be, but we're forming too many stars early, if you want. The star formation rate should be reduced early on. Now, one thing that I didn't tell you is that in the original ARIS, for which I've discussed mostly the results so far, we had a limitation that because we were working on a mass scale where just below 10 to the 12, where you know the cold mode accretion is supposed to be the main mechanism from which the gas gets into the halo, we were not using metal lines at high temperatures. We were using metal lines to 10 to the 4 and lower, but not at high temperature. But the issue is that the supernova ejecta get to 10 to the 5 or more, and there the cooling through metal lines can be important. So what we discovered when we rerun various versions of ARIS with metal line cooling is that it was harder to get a reasonable stellar mass. We stopped the runs on high redshift because it was clear already, if you compare this blue line, which is the original ARIS, that by redshift zero gets to this mass comparable to the Milky Way, to a run which has now the high temperature metal line cooling, it's clear that the mass is diverging to a much larger value. The stellar mass is not going to match the stellar mass of the Milky Way. So then what we tried in the last year or so, actually Xi Jing Shen has done all the simulations so far, is to look at different parameters for feedback and also modify our feedback recipes in order to try to recover the previous good agreement that we had with ARIS on the stellar mass as a first constraint. And for example, if you increase the effect of feedback by just arbitrarily allowing the gas to not cool for twice the time, so not 10 but 20 million years, that's what you get. You start getting closer to the old prediction, but the structure of the disk now is the problem, because in the original ARIS you had a very nice thin disk. This is a redshift one. When the disk is beginning to assemble, you already see the disk here superimposed on the central bulge. Whereas in models with stronger feedback, which get the stellar mass correctly, we do end up with something which looks more like a zero galaxy. So the price to pay for adding the feedback and getting the stellar mass correct is that you get a much more turbulent, thick, kinematically hot disk, which has nothing to do with a disk of a spiral galaxy. And I think at the moment, this is a major issue in zoom-in simulations. I think AMR simulations by Rock Roschker and Roman also find the same tension between either reproducing the stellar masses or reproducing a kinematically cold stellar and gaseous disk, which is, of course, something that you require in a realistic model of a disk galaxy. So I personally think that's a major problem that one has to think of. I mean, we have heard different ways of doing feedback that may offer an alternative that may or not solve this major issue. I think the message that we are getting from our new Risturans by changing all possible things, including changing the formulation of SPH, including non-thermal pressure feedback, and other, we are also going to include radiative feedback. And, so far what we have found is that it's very hard to do this, and therefore to maintain a larger fraction of disk in a warm non-star forming case, but at the same time avoid to stir or pressurize the whole ISM. So you have to be able to do both, but so far we haven't succeeded. Now, in the last 3 minutes or so, I wanted to just mention about this new result that we had on larger mass scales. Again, the same feedback model, same resolution for the highest resolution run, at least. Then we also have lower resolution that we can evolve for longer. And here we look at a much larger mass scale, 2 times 10 to the 13 solar masses redshift 0. The high resolution run has the same resolution of Eris, 10 to the 4 solar masses in gas mass and 100 parsecs in gravitational softening. We have no AGM feedback. Maybe it's an erratic approach, but we like to start with a minimal approach and see what we can get out of that. And what we found is that we have a major quenching episode in the galaxy that is forming at the center of the halo. A redshift 4 is a clear, nice blue disk. A redshift 2 has become a quenched spheroidal object. And then, you know, we looked at what happens between redshift 4 and redshift 2 that does that. We have no AGM feedback at all. We only have the same supernova feedback which I was describing before, which is believed to be not effective at this mass scale. So we checked that the galaxies that we were obtaining were reasonable. So these are different resolution runs. The HR is the one with the same resolution in Eris, and the other ones are 8 times or 60 times lower resolution. We go up and down in the M-star M halo, but roughly we are following it within a factor of 2. The sizes of the simulated the various version of this galaxy, redshift 2, are in the ballpark of what the data say. So it seems that the galaxy at redshift 2 is not unreasonable. So then we looked at the star formation, the specific star formation rate evolution, and what you see is that you are in the blue sequence until some point, and then you drop. The high resolution run is still running and it stopped here for the time we did the plot, but the low resolution ones are now at redshift 2, and you can see that they're dropping. Here you are in the green valley. You will end up very soon, roughly, at this level of star formation rate, you will end up in the red sequence. So you're close to get to the red sequence. And we tried to turn off feedback, even the supernova feedback, to see whether that was a crucial effect, and no, it's not. The run without supernova feedback, that's a cyan line, follows the same trend. It has a bit more star formation per unit mass, so the specific star formation is a bit higher, but the trend is the same. There's a quenching phase that is initiated by something. So let me actually go to this, the other one, because I have almost no time, and that's actually the bottom line. So we looked at how the mass is accreted, and what we found is that until redshift 3.5, 3.3, which is just before the quenching happens, everything, so the dark halo, the total, of course, and then the gas and stars, are accreting very fast. It's a nearly exponential slope, and everything is sustained. Star formation is sustained, and the gas inflow is sustained. And of course, star formation comes from the gas that is piling in from mostly cold flows inside the galaxy. Then dark matter, the dark material begins to grow a little bit at outer radius, at the Viria radius. But if you go to say just a third of the Viria radius, there's almost no accretion of dark matter anymore. So it's like the dark matter halo is really entering in a slow mode of accretion, with just a little bit of matter accreted from outside at the boundary. But overall, it's growing much less than before. You know, you go from exponential to just a bit more than constant. Okay, and this corresponds exactly to the time at which also the gas and stars begin to slow down in their accretion and the galaxy quenches. So, of course, this is only one case. We don't know how common this is. That's what we dubbed cosmological starvation. Again, it's nothing to do with other effects that people have seen in the past, because it doesn't have to do with the cold dot mode transition. All the gas, cold and hot, begins to slowly accrete, so without, you know, essentially, you know, with very little added mass. And it doesn't happen because of AGM feedback, and it's not correlated with mergers. So we are going to look into this more in detail to see how general it is and why other people have not seen that, which you can ask me, of course, in the question time. So I think I lay down my conclusions here. And as I said, I think the biggest challenge at the moment, at least in the zoom-in simulation, is to be able to form a realistic galaxy like Eris was appearing to be, but with a more properly, you know, a more physically motivated feedback model that allows to get both the stellar mass and the structure of the disk correct. And I'll leave it here.
Lucia?
So how did you select the mass accretion history, or this halo basically with this specific mass accretion history? Was any pre-selection done?
No, it doesn't have it. So historically what happened is that, so in, 3 years ago we wrote another paper using a lower resolution version of the simulation that I showed you, and other two simulations which had the same mass scale. And the three were chosen in a way that one had a very extreme accretion history, so in a very high density environment. Another one was in an under dense environment, and this was one, the one in between, so in a sort of average environment. And that's the one that we looked at here. So there's nothing really special. It doesn't. So if you look at the over density within a few megaparsecs, it's really just above one.
So that's not in a group today?
No. Well, it's the galaxy itself is the group, right? So the main galaxy will become a fossil group, if you want, something like X-ray bright fossil group.
I have a question here. So could you highlight the difference between this quenching by not accreting more mass compared to the halo quenching that people used to talk before?
Yeah, not so here it's really, you know, it's the, what we are finding, as I said here, is that is really the slowing down of the growth of the dark matter that is initiating the quenching. It's not something to do with a different phase of gas, you know, going from
so
cold to hot
mode.
Yeah. It's the potential weather is growing at a different speed than before. Avishai. No, please.
But so the morphology of the galaxy is like an elliptical galaxy?
By this time, you know, by redshift 2, what we have is a galaxy that has already built a substantial slowly rotating spheroid, but still has, you know, the V over sigma would be still close to 0.7, 0.8. So it's not. It probably better call it an S0 at this stage in time. It's not what you would call a typical elliptical yet.
So maybe if you shut down the supply of fresh gas, the disk is like of too much stable and cannot get to high density anymore because of the spheroid, and so the effective Q is much more than one, and everything stops maybe.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's also fair to say that, you know, what happens later, we don't know. You could have another phase again, and you may need some radio mode or some, you know, later feedback to keep it on the right sequence. Dush. Or
so Lucio, I wondered what triggers the burst of star formation in your dwarf galaxies? Is it
in the dwarfs?
Yeah.
So typically what, so the mergers are one of the causes of the strongest bursts. So the early mergers before redshift 1.5 or 2. And that's actually the time when you begin to form the core. So and there's another paper which I didn't mention, I wasn't a co-author of that, but Chris Brook has looked at that in detail. And he has really seen that in some of these dwarf simulations, the strongest effect comes when a lot of gas comes in through mergers at early times, and you have stronger bursts and begin a core formation.
I mean, I was just thinking, if you looked at, you know, the rare local dwarf that's bursting, you'd find environmental triggering, I think, in almost all cases, but like the nature of it would differ a lot, right? You'd look at M82 mm-hmm. and say, okay, it's in the M81 group, it interacted with a more massive galaxy.
Right.
You'd look at NGC 1569 and say, okay, there's a cloud of gas there that's a tenth the baryonic mass of the galaxy that it interacted with. And it'd be interesting to me, like, you know, how the range of environmental processes for a 10 to the 8
right.
mass galaxy, you know, how that changes with redshift, kind of.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the very small dwarfs, the smallest ones that I showed before, the ones that form star very, very late, they are triggered not by a merger, but more by a flyby, you know, tidal interaction with the bigger dwarf. So yeah, there are a variety of ways that you can actually excite them. And, yeah, I agree that it would be interesting to look at all these effects.
I was just wondering if this was simulated with the old or new version of gasoline.
No, so this one here, this one on purpose, I wanted to start with simulating it exactly in the same way as Eris and also the earlier dwarf galaxy simulations, to avoid introduce too many other, you know, parameters and aspects of the simulations. We are going to rerun it with thermal diffusion and pressure-based SPH, just to check effects. But this is exactly like Eris, essentially. It's the same setup.
It's just because in this older SPH version, they tend to suppress cooling of the hot atmosphere. So I was wondering if that plays a role or not.
I can tell you that when the runs that we have redone for Eris, we don't really see any major effect in the sense of what you're saying. The really major effect comes from adding or not adding the metal line cooling at high temperatures. Yeah.
One more question? You have one? Okay.
The question regarding this star formation, you see of this dwarf that you said that had a very late one that basically had its first burst of star formation at a lookback time of 4 giga years. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about its environment?
So the seven dwarfs are in a group, you know, that is, you know, there's a dominant dwarf, which is the biggest one. And the other ones, they are, say, by the time they show this burst, they are within the virial radius of the bigger one, which is the reason why they're excited by a tidal interaction.
Yeah. Okay, so let's thank Lucho again.
So yeah, congratulations to us, we're almost there. Many were lost in the way, so our brains are pro. So I'll try to keep it very short, just try to wake up and stimulate some discussion. So during the talks, I just put some things together. Let's see if any of this picks up, otherwise I will go down and down on the list. So this last session was a good example of the dual approach that the field is taking, at least at the scale of galaxies. On one hand, we have these large volume simulations that that attempt to model the whole population of galaxies without trying to get the physics right, maybe, versus this zoom-in technique into one or a handful of objects that aims at trying to understand the physics a bit better. So, of course, if you think about the observational constraints, they are stronger for the former, for the first approach. We can look at populations, galaxy bimodalities, we can look at mass functions, correlation functions, etc. We know how our simulation should look like. Instead, if we zoom in into an object, we don't know. We assume that it should form a disk, because usually disks are sexier. And then we tune the things until we get a disk. So the question here comes, so shall we continue with these two approaches independently? Shall we favor one with the other? And especially is how to try, I think we should continue with both, but we should put some effort on the crosstalk between both communities here. But this becomes a bit more difficult when we go to the second point, that is about convergence. So it was discussed a couple of times during the talks that if you zoom in or you increase your resolution, at some point you don't expect more convergence anymore. But if that is true, how are we going to do this? How do we do this task? How do you even trust a simulation, right? The simulations have thousands of lines. We take me to the last one, right? To the last of the things put here. Why do we believe this at all? Okay, there's plenty of room for bugs. So how do we improve the credibility of our codes? How do we, you know, we always find H factors that are lost here and there. Okay, so shall we maybe put more effort on this convergence? Shall we spend any time trying to find verifiable tests for our simulations? Or we just, you know, carry on and hope for the best? All right.
Well, I guess I just want to say that one of the key differences between all the zoom-in techniques would come in the general velocity structure and phase structure of the winds produced in the simulations. And I think once we are able to constrain those better with observations, we should be able to at least use the first class of models more accurately if we can have a distribution of velocity, a distribution of temperatures that are consistent with, that are fixed on observed results and are reproduced in zoom-ins. And at that point, the two types of simulation should come closer together.
I think that is a very good point. Now, from the small scale community, I noticed that there was hardly any questions from them during the last session. And I fear that although we believe that by doing zoom-ins, we're doing a more physical approach, I think when we talk to them, they don't really think this has anything to do with physics. Or maybe they just don't understand because we just go too fast over the details of our models. So maybe one of the small scale community can tell us what do they thought. Okay, thanks.
I'll just say that the real ISM is multi-phase, and so the cold layer is always near the midplane. So when you discussed, for example, you know, how to make the have feedback and yet form stars near the midplane, the stars will form at the midplane in the real case where the cold gas sinks to the midplane. Yeah. And most of the mass is always in the cold phase, or colder phases, I should say, the warm and cold.
What do you mean by cold here?
Cold is less than 100 Kelvin. Warm is between 100 and 10,000.
Okay.
I can use this already. I know. I completely agree. I guess, you know, from the perspective of trying to recover what we had in the original Ares, it looks like this simple change of adding or not adding the meta lines at more than 10 to the 4K made a transition between forming the stars in the midplane, as you are saying, to not forming them in the midplane anymore. So now the issue is, how do we go back to the right results with a more realistic feedback, which also includes, of course, the cooling of meta lines?
Well, one thing I didn't understand is what you do about stellar heating.
About what?
Stellar heating.
No, we don't include it's only the supernova, yeah.
Right, because again, the main input to the interstellar medium is UV from stars.
I know, but my worry is that, as I said, you know, if you pressurize the ISM, it may be a question of resolution, but at the resolution that we have, the attempts that we have made to include that now in a subgrid fashion, so adding an additional pressure term or an additional heating term, which we are working on at the moment, they seem to always give this result that you end up with a galaxy that has an overly pressurized medium everywhere. So it may be that it's just a resolution issue, that we are not at the resolution that is good enough to be able to separate the phases correctly. That might be the reason, but I'm not sure.
Okay, let's move on to my next point that is kind of nice. So, Lucio kind of introduced a bit of a history of the field, and that justifies this bulge phobia that is always in the community. That if you were giving a talk about disk galaxies and your galaxy happened to have a bulge, you feel ashamed. You try to hide it. You choose the color scheme such that it's not visible. So now that it seems to be a bit easier to form disks, to form disks in cosmological simulations, will we get rid of that feeling? Can we now go ahead and proudly show our galaxy with half of the mass in the bulge and half of it in the disk? I think this goes a bit along. So Alison made a comment citing one of the works. Don't remember. I think it was Michael Aumer. And it's, I think it's true. There were like a wave of papers saying, "Hey, we can form these galaxies, and they fit this, and they fit that." There was that group and many other ones. I think that is was actually a good thing. For many years, the field was stuck with maybe one or very few codes could do it. So I think now many codes can do it, and I think that is a good thing. Forming disks is not easy; it requires a lot of redistribution of angular momentum and stuff. So, but now that we know that we can do it, can we move on and say something about early-type galaxies? Can we stop about this obsession about Milky Way bulge-less galaxies? And are we going to learn anything else about keep investing a lot of time on making things like the Milky Way?
I mean, I think what we'd like to see is a set of zoom-in simulations instead of a zoom-in simulation of one galaxy and what that distribution of bulge to disk ratios is.
Right. I agree. I think we are slowly moving there. Where is that? Somebody has the other mic?
Okay. I actually just wanted to add on to your second point about now that we do match all these global scaling relations, should we move on to more massive galaxies? I actually view it in a different way, where we have been chasing Milky Way mass, and especially dwarf galaxies, for decades. And now that I think we find ourselves being so successful, we shouldn't move on. We should actually start making predictions, right? For to actually test the different models. That's how I view it, actually.
So something maybe related to that is that so all these papers that came out saying that they could produce nicely looking disks, maybe something that they didn't do such a good job was putting labels of what was the physics responsible for the success. So it's fine if you can find your disks and you fit all the observational evidence that is out there. But now boring this down to say this was early feedback, radiation pressure was whatever. I think that introduced a bit of noise, not necessarily helping the community.
No, I just wanted to add that, you know, to okay, too much to the extent of being obsessive about this, but I think this issue of the H kinematics relation is a crucial one, and I'd like to hear comments maybe from Dushan about whether you have looked at the kinematics of the disks with the more sophisticated subgrid feedback models that you use now.
So we don't have any results to share, but I think, as I mentioned on Monday, Freka van der Voort is actually looking into bulge diffractions, kinematic thick and thin disk, and hopefully we'll have something out soon. So, but I don't have anything to share. I mean, one of the three galaxies we have at Milky Way mass, it actually has really nice rotating disk. The other two are mostly bulgy, but we are trying to characterize and to understand actually what's contributing to each of these classes.
Right. So maybe I would say this field has seen a huge progress over the last 2 years in actually, finally getting to realistically looking disk galaxies. However, to do so, some of the feedback was inserted by hand and,
That's right.
Put to, quite dramatic values, like sometimes overshooting the energy that is actually available, or switching off cooling. So I would say, in order to solve this problem, I would feel more comfortable if there would be some sort of more realistically modeled physics that actually does the job without tuning the stuff by hand, like doing the radiative transfer actually more realistically, or putting in cosmic rays or magnetic fields, which we know exist in our Milky Way.
Okay, so that connects very nicely with the other bullet. So if we, so when Eris came out, they had a lot of press, so much that my mom sent me an email saying, hey, look, the work, or whatever you were trying to do, was done. Now you can come back home, all right? So now I'm actually happy to see that there are still things that are not so much sorted out. I can still justify staying far away from my mom. So, but one of these things, you know, the way in which the results were presented was, okay, you add early feedback or radiation pressure or whatever, it's all done. So it takes you to say, okay, all the things that we learned from the small scale community that we saw so nicely in this conference, cosmic rays, magnetic fields, we already match everything. There is no need to add all this. So I think there is still hope that we don't actually match all the things that we should match, and we should continue pushing the efforts here.
I guess I just wanted to make a comment about the galactic winds, because it seems like some of the galactic winds we heard throughout the week, especially today, seem to have parameters that are a bit unrealistic, like mass loading factors that are really seems excessive. Maybe that depends on the simulations, but I think theorists should really consider that the observation don't suggest this sort of extreme winds, and maybe that's a parameter that should be toned down and see what happens with the results. The other thing that I wanted to mention is there's really no evidence, and it pains me to say that, but there's really no evidence for winds in the low redshift, and even at intermediate redshift, winds that extend much beyond a few tens of kiloparsecs. So that's something that one's to you probably need to consider also, or just be a bit careful about having these winds that extends on 100 kiloparsecs, it seems, on, in some simulations. So.
So on your last point, I think that's an interesting question, and I think it's a trap to believe that you have you can be complacent because you've perfectly matched observations, because you've perfectly matched observations with a bunch of subgrid scale models, some of which really are quite crude. So I would strongly suggest that the community take the advice of one of the former comments, that on the things that you can produce more ab initio physics-based models that you currently have as subgrid scale models, you take that very seriously before you run off to say, well, we need these other things. And you probably do need these other things, but don't fall into the trap of complacency with a bunch of models that are very crude, and now we've matched everything.
I think it's a very good advice. We are running out of time.
I'd like to round the party a little bit about its perfect matched observations on galactic scales. I think it's pretty much, or much of it is achieved by tweaking the parameters, like in semi-analytic modeling. So we tweak the subgrid physics until we get the match. This doesn't mean we really understand the physical processes. So this meeting was really good about the part where stellar feedback was, at least we tried to touch the physics in some of the lectures, some of the discussion. But I don't think we have reached this at all in what is in these nice matches to all those observations. Does anybody understand AGN feedback in this room? But if you ask,
we'll leave it for later.
If you ask everybody in the field, they tell you AGN feedback is the most important feedback process in galaxy formation. Because we put it in, we put the parameters one way or another, and we get roughly the right slope, and we are happy. And many things are like that. I want to tell you something that I encountered in the last few weeks. I played around a lot with tumor disk instability and how important it is, and it's working very well, and try to understand. But I realized very recently that in our simulations, most of the unstable disks at high redshift have Q parameters above unity. Okay? So tumor, I would not agree to call it tumor instability. It's a nonlinear effect. It's actually triggered by some nonlinear encounters, mergers, and so on. It's never linear thing that starts growing. Okay? So, yes, we modeled it, we see it, we roughly understand, we see clumps, but I think we're far from physical understanding. And so on and so forth. I can give you a whole lecture about how poorly we understand the physics of what we are trying to play with.
Oh, that was depressing. That was the depressing closing.
Perfect note. Conclusion.
Okay, so let's just give a big round of applause to all the organizers of this wonderful conference. Yeah.